after the funeral.
First, you know nothing, but they like you. Then, second, you know stuff, but they hate your guts. Between popular uselessness and loathed effectiveness, you have... how long? About a weekend.
The Master.
The funeral had been a long one, in a polychromatic Anglican church so high that the streets for half a mile around smelled of incense. It had apparently been the ex-Lord Chancellor's wish to inflict on all his atheist friends the full rigour of a proper funeral service. A wit and a man of faith, as well as pederast, he had long abhorred services with Beatles music and heart-tugging slideshows of the deceased as a young child. Ritual was the best sedative for sorrow, common wisdom which had been forgotten. So all of those milk-and-water agnostics and politically correct pew-dodgers had had to sit through the endless readings from the penitential Psalms, from Corinthians and Revelation, from the St. James Bible, to kneel for prayers, shuffle forward for the Eucharist, and sit again for a socking-long sermon that made disapproving reference to the All Hallows Party. The ex-Prime Minister, universally known as the Master, who was in his way a serious believer, had read one of the lessons. After the service, with the coffin taken away for burial, half a dozen members of his former cabinets had stood around, stretching their backs and rubbing their buttocks and wondering about lunch. The Master had a brace of limousines waiting, and he took them half a mile away, beyond the reach of the paparazzi, to a quiet public house, the moon in her glory. A back room once reserved for the ladies. A battered round deal table, half a dozen Victorian chairs, and a hatch for the beer.
"White wine spritzers, everyone?"
asked the former Prime Minister, slapping his hands together.
"A wee spritzer,"
spluttered Murdoch White, the former Foreign Secretary and Defence Secretary.
"Hell's bells, you always were a degenerate metropolitan ponce. A small whiskey and half of IPA for me."
"Murdoch, Murdoch, so predictable, you're an incorrigible dinosaur. You're like a bigoted, scaly old sea monster that only comes up once a decade to roll your eyes at us. Anyway, that was what we always drank."
"Aye, when you were sodding Prime Minister it was. We'd have drunk cabbage water if you told us to. No, you're not."
One by one, the others, Margaret Miller, former Home Secretary, Sally Johnson, former party chair, Alex Brodie, industry and then briefly Chancellor, the sly, Machiavellian figure of Leslie Kahn, the party fixer and Northern Ireland secretary, ordered their drinks. None of them asked for a spritzer. The Master recovered quickly.
"Well, it may not be a proper oak table, but here we are assembled, the Knights of the Grail, together again for the first time since my esteemed former Chancellor broke the enchantment and cast us out. Yeah, yeah, I'm joking, guys, come on. But it's kind of good to be together again, isn't it?"
"Bloody sad too, though,"
said Murdoch in a gravelly Ayrshire growl.
"Yes, poor old Simon, what a way to go. He had many more years in him, I'd have thought," said the ex-Prime Minister.
"No, no, I didn't mean that," said Murdoch, "though it's a pity the poor bastard died with the anger on him. No, I meant it's a bloody pity we're all here out in the cold, fuck all use to anybody. Just sad."
Miller and Johnson, the two gatekeeper women who had supported the PM to the last and beyond, broke in, protesting. Their leader, the Master, was doing good work in the Middle East and raising large sums for Africa with his speeches. They both spoke at some length, and the Master had the grace to look faintly embarrassed. When they'd finished, he shook his head, rapped at the table as if calling for silence, and began to talk in that familiar tone of unctuous, confiding seriousness.
"No, Maggie. No, Sally. Murdoch makes a very good point. Yes, of course. We all do what we can. Public service runs through us.
It's in our DNA. But where it counts most, here at home, we've become completely voiceless. New Labour has vanished back into the Labour Party with, I have to say, entirely predictable results. The Tories have ripped us out of Europe. The Scots are off, partly, I confess, my fault. It's back to a choice, apparently, between permanent class war or heartless free market fundamentalism. Fairness or efficiency, but never both. Exactly the choice we devoted our lives to eliminating. I've never been as depressed about this country as I am now. We have capitalism, but we have no social democracy. It's a bloody waste. And the worst of it is, Leslie Kahn interjected, we're all actually at the height of our powers. I know things I learned the hard way as a minister, and I've learned new things in business since. I know how to make a government department work, and I know how to rally public opinion, but I can't get a hearing. The newspapers, for what they're worth, won't commission articles from any of us. They don't even pick up on our blogs or tweets. That little shit who made fools of us all at his damned party had a point, perhaps. We are the politically undead. We live in limbo. We've always been frank with ourselves, so let's be frank now. This is a convocation of fucking zombies. Agreed, said the master. Lurid language, but not so far from the truth. It might be a limbo of air-conditioned offices and first-class flights with the occasional television studio thrown in, but it's a limbo nevertheless. Whenever I think I'm going to be let back into the conversation, when there's the right Newsnight moment or whatever, I do my bloody best, but it's all yada, 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 Iraq, illegal war, liar, blah, blah, blah.
Fucking cunts, interjected Murdoch. Hypocritical little shits. God, I hate the fucking Guardian.
That got everybody, even Leslie Kahn, who had once worked there, nodding their heads and grunting. It goes back to my old paradox, the master again. When you first arrive in power, you have maximum authority. You are the people's choice. You have momentum, the wind at your back. But you don't know how to do anything. By the time you've learned the lessons, worked out where the levers are and how to use them, sucked up all the tricks of survival, then 10 to 1 your authority is gone. You've become discredited, disgraced, or merely boring. It's all over. You can have either wisdom or power, but never both at the same time. So my question is this. Under such an arrangement, how can a serious democracy ever be properly run? There was silence. The chips and the sandwiches arrived. Even they looked sad. The former Prime Minister continued. You end up with the next lot of innocents, perhaps not making exactly the same mistakes, but lots of new mistakes on their own. Miliband, Grimaldi. And by the time they've learned from them again, it's too late and they're out. For the past few years, I've worked on the assumption that there's nothing that can be done about this. Our faces are no longer welcome. Nobody listens to us anymore, and they never will. So all that accumulated understanding, from little wisdom to a lot of gamesmanship, is just going to go to waste. But recently, I've been wondering. Leslie, Murdoch, girls, need it be so? If our faces are too old, let's find some new faces. If we can't use what we know for ourselves, why can't we use it for others? When the left, the unions, don't like the way the party's going, they don't just sit back. They organise, as we know to our cost, and they try to take the power back. Is there any reason we can't do the same? Kahn was brushing his little beard with tapering fingers. A little smile of delight appeared on his face.
Oh, Master, you're not suggesting we run moles, are you?
entryists, like a bunch of trots, barked White.
No, not as such. But if we could identify just a few bright, talented, potential new leaders and help them up the ladder, we could control the party by proxy. Fresh skins, sleepers, call them what you will. But sleepers for common sense, moles for the American alliance, entryists for a sensible European future. All that.
Manchurian candidates?
Well, said the former Prime Minister, we don't need to go as far as brainwashing, still less assassination, do we? Just a little help here and there? A team. And we give the party a new leader, a better leader. A leader we have shaped and who we control. Once we thought the future was ours. Let us dare to think it again. The Early Life of David Petrie. If you want to survive in politics, you need to have deep roots. And if you don't, you have to pretend to. The Master. For a small country, Scotland is geographically complicated. Parts of Ayrshire, for instance, look like the Highlands, particularly when the cloud is low. Shaggy, dun-coloured moorlands are populated by shaggy, shitty-bottomed sheep crowding across roads that weren't resurfaced during the long reign of Queen Elizabeth. Just as in the Highlands, you drive past grey, harled, barrack-like settlements of 1960s council housing, their desolate gardens fenced in with wire, and defeated co-op stores and scowling public houses with wired windows. But when the clouds lift, the absence of soaring mountains becomes apparent. Instead, weak rifts of sunlight show giant A's of steel and collections of industrial buildings. For this was once mining country, with conical bings like burial mounds of ancient Strathclyde kings. And even now, years after Margaret Thatcher's death, the rusting steel sheds and the pervasive layer of coal dust haven't gone. So this is a country where it's easy to answer the question, why do folk get involved in politics? If you relied on the papers, you'd think it was pure greed with a pinch of vanity. And you'd be wrong. In David Petrie's Ayrshire, being Labour was like going to Mass, like learning to drink half and halves, like supporting Kilmarnock, and like not hitting your women. It was what a proper, decent, grown man did. The folk memory of the miners' strike, the poll tax, the closure of Ravenscraig was transmitted almost wordlessly father to son, mother to daughter. And if a man needed any more explanation, the pudgy, braying faces on television, though Blair, mind you, was as bad as a Tory, rammed the lesson home. There were sides, us and them. Them, us. Christ sakes, pal, what more did you need to know? It wasn't like that now, though. The Labour folk had been split and scattered by the 2014 independence referendum. These days the Nats were better organised, strutting through the streets. Yes, badges all over the place, cocky as you like. The saltier flew over the council chambers. But it wasn't always so. Back then, being Labour was bleeding obvious. The system, the whole bloody world, was set up to screw the working classes. The working classes had no choice but to fight back. Only the odd funny-looking Tory in tartan trews, maybe, or Presbyterian minister or some kind of orangeman didn't get it. David Petrie had known this all his life. Later on, when he was famous, everybody got Petrie's story subtly wrong. Wikipedia, the BBC website, profiles in both The Spectator and The New Statesman, and hurriedly written biography by a rising young journalist, all missed what really mattered. Yet nobody would ever be able to say that Davy himself had lied about his own background. The public story, the official story, was all bootstrappy and hard graft.
David Petrie had grown up in a working-class family in a village south of Glasgow, joining the trade union movement early and working his way up through scholarships to create his own building company, paying top-dollar wages to his boys, handing over chunks of his profits to local causes. It was a story of Catholic self-improvement, of the importance of family, the story of a clean-limbed hero. No university drinking clubs, no wealthy behind-the-scenes patrons. Just a simple, passionate, moderate, justice-loving man of the streets. And a lot of that was true, but it was a sunny painting without shadows or dark corners. So much so that the truth was a lie. There had been little that was decent or working class about David Petrie's early life. He had been born in a privately owned bungalow in an Ayrshire village to an alcoholic local builder, a formidable bully, and his long-suffering, though in fact highly intelligent, wife. Later on, David Petrie would be famous as a kind of survivor, like the sole cavalryman making it back from the Khyber Pass, all his comrades lying slaughtered in pools of their own blood. That is, he was a rare Scottish Labour MP after the Nationalists had poured down the mountainsides in 2015. Somehow, like a burr, he'd clung on. As Scottish voices had begun to disappear from London public life, Petrie's Ayrshire tones were still being heard in Parliament and on the BBC, an almost reassuring reminder of times that had gone. "I feel like a dinosaur, to be honest, woken up to find the mammals have taken over," he'd once said on Breakfast News. But like the dinosaurs, there was something unshakably tough, almost stony, about the man. David's first memories were of fear and pain. His father's head was out of focus, a blur of grey and red, but his hands and feet were close. Knuckles, the signet ring, the smell of shoe polish, a boot in the arse, a giant hand scrunching his jumper and lifting him up. Bellow, scalp. Sometimes when the gate slammed and he heard Dar's feet coming up the steps, he filled his pants and trousers with hot pee. Then he was disgusted with himself and almost welcomed the belting. It was an old, weathered black belt with a metal buckle. The boy David was also smacked, punched, left out in the garden in all weathers, and subject, as he grew up, to all the torments a self-pitying builder could devise. A Christmas holiday full of unlikely winks and vague enticing promises would be followed by a Christmas morning, silent and presentless. Dar Oot, Moore locked in her bedroom. Dar Oot, mind you, was a damn sight better than Dar Inn.
"Come away, son. It's time you came down to the football. Dinna look so bloody scared. We're going to have a good time, you and me."
And sometimes good things followed. A chip butty, a can of icy iron brew, being taught how to take a drag, deep and fragrant and blue. But Dar's moods were as changeable as scudding clouds. One can too many, a missed scoring opportunity. Cheek from the visitor's terrace. Then he'd feel a sudden poke on the nape of his neck.
"See, my boy, a wee Jesse I've got is all. Don't understand a bloody thing about the game. Don't know why I bother bringing you, do I, Dolores?"
Even Dar's mates thought he went too far.
"Dolores, big man, where the fuck's that come from? Well, look at the wee girl with her big dark eyes. Doesn't need mascara. Did you ever see sic a sight?"
And his dar was always right, of course. The tears stung their way down the side of his nose and mixed with snot and hung on his lip. He'd have his grey woollen jersey on, bought from the co-op, and he'd wipe himself with the sleeve. And then his dar would whack him across the side of his face, and his dar's friends would go, "Christ's sake, Bobby," but maybe laugh. And the boys on the field would win or lose, but it didn't matter much. He wasn't a great boy for the football. And then back at home, the belt. thick black leather with wee yellow lines where it was cracking and with the metal thistle buckle at the business end. Beer and the belt. They went together like love and marriage. Many years later, the adult David Petrie was told while being examined after a skiing accident that he had broken no fewer than 4 ribs as a child. He remembered the sleepless nights all right. At the time, there was no question of hospital. But a few deep white scars like chalk marks still remained on his back and legs. The adult David Petrie was known as a snappy dresser, flash suits. The truth was, he bought suits with braces. He never wore belts. The adult David Petrie enjoyed a drink, a beer, a glass of wine, a gin and tonic. But the very faintest smell of Scotland's national drink, the sick sweet scent from his father's open mouth, brought an instant queasiness. He simply couldn't stand the stuff. His dad, Bob Petrie, was a very popular man. David only realised this much later. Dar was liked. Other men wanted Dar to be their friend. Out of the house, he told jokes. People laughed at them. Big Bob was a good workman and a relaxed boss. He liked to drink, everyone knew that, and where's the harm there? The bungalow was on the very outskirts of the village, surrounded by its own hedge. In space, enough space, a wee bit lawn around a wee bit house. No one can hear you scream. Big Bob's big laugh, though, was well known in the pub. A low staccato series of growly grunts, hick, 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 building up to a full-throated har, har, har. There was a lot of laughing. His business grew fast, swollen by contracts from the local council. This was Labour territory, Labour people, Labour laughing. Bob was friends with the councillors and actually a Labour Party member himself, although he never turned up at ward meetings.
Need time for blethering, no offence, boys, I've got a business to run.
Only later on would Davy understand the kickbacks, the backhanders, the know-nothing-for-nothing. Those raucous sessions in the bar were always about business first.
Hick, hick, har, har.
Big Bob sweated easily as he grew ever larger, but he was not a man to waste energy or time. Neither David nor his mother Eileen were seen much in the village. They felt, as they looked, at the edge of things. Sunday school, the scouts, even lining up to jeer the idiot Orangemen all passed them by. Bob was careful not to hit his wife on the face or arms, one of those tricks of civilised life passed down from some fathers to some sons. As David grew older and bigger, Bob's weekly beltings were replaced by the more painful methods of verbal terrorism. Jibes about his voice, mockery of his changing body, a hot, moist, whiskery, whiskied mouth at a bright red ear, a finger and thumb pulling him up by his sideburn.
Big girls blows ya.
Once, just once, when he was changing for football at school, a teacher, Miss Lecky, had seen fresh welts on his legs. A social worker had come round to the house. David could still remember the tense little quartet of them sitting in the best room, his father forcing smiles and joshing,
hick, hick, har, har,
like one of those plays from the telly. There was never the slightest chance of David being taken into care. Nobody wanted that. Bob's connections made it completely impossible. Anyway, Davy would have hated leaving his mother alone in that overheated but cheerless house. Mere misery doesn't kill you, not in Scotland. Davy grew up to be a silent, handsome, self-possessed young man. Layer over layer, skin on thickening skin. And life got better. He found schoolwork ridiculously easy. The school library was small enough, but he read his way through it, the whole damned room. Maths, encyclopedias, cowboy stories, it didn't matter. His second great escape as a teenager was discovering a natural talent for, of all things, football. He made the school team a year early. Bob, the big man, found this very hard to deal with. For years it had been an important part of his story that his son was a Jesse. Yet here he was, big long legs scoring goals and coming home covered in mud and bruises week after week. Grudgingly, Bob made his way to the touchline once or twice. Laddie worth something after all. Maybe he and David would finally have a real conversation, a Scottish one, of course, elliptical and self-mocking, more silence than words, but ending in grunts of assent and a feeling not unlike warmth. They never made it. When David was 17, Bob was hit by a car as he was coming out of the pub. He was killed instantly, blood all over the pavement. Eileen laughed when Councillor Daly and the police came round to break the news, which was put down to shock. "The poor soul, she can't accept it." "Eh, poor Eileen, what's she going to do with you, Bob?" But David watched as her smile failed to disappear, remaining almost constantly on her lips for a full week afterwards. It was the most shocking thing he'd ever seen, but the truth was, he felt better too. When he came home from school in the afternoons, Eileen had sometimes put the television on and was sitting boldly in the best room, eating ginger snaps. Bob's funeral was a big affair in the village. The sun shone, the fields around brimming with rasps, and the dancing shores of Tatties, King Eddies and Desirees mostly, glinted and waved in the sunlight. There was a holiday air. By now many of the fields had been filled in by the spreading housing estate. Nice houses, big windows, decent-sized rooms. Bob did good work, so that the boundary between town and village had almost closed up. Councillors and local bigwigs were all there, and the crowd from the pub and a dozen relatives from Glasgow. So the R.C. chapel was packed. The local MP, a tall, pale, droning man, gave the eulogy, talking of how many houses for ordinary, decent labour folk Bob Petrie's men had built. What a supporter he had been of good causes. "Aye, a hand in his pocket!" And how Misty would be as a father and husband. At this, he poked the air almost animatedly as if he was looking to be contradicted. Davy, a man today almost bursting out of his new suit, looked straight ahead with a solemn expression. His mother caused a flutter in the pews behind her by audibly snorting. She raised her chin, smiled slightly, and looked straight at the priest, a ferrety, pockmarked little Irishman, who avoided her gaze. Bob's death had brought calm, even a kind of peace, to the bungalow. He didn't leave much behind in the way of clutter. Eileen took his golf clubs and the porcelain model of Robert Burns he'd once given her down to the Oxfam shop along with his clothes. But David Petrie's hopes for university were over. He'd been offered places at Glasgow, 60 miles north, and further away still at St. Andrews. Everybody said he was very smart. One teacher had used the word preternatural, which he and his mother had had to look up and had a good laugh about. He had hoped to study engineering or maybe even history. But the foreman, one of the few of his father's friends David had liked, had come to him and Eileen and made it clear that the business would vanish if there was no one to succeed. A plan was agreed. Uncle Marky, a prosperous lawyer from Airdrie, would step in as boss for a year or two while David learned the ropes. Then, if it still existed, the business would be his. Nursing a pint in the Railwaymen's Social Club, Uncle Marky spoke about Davy to some of the lads from Petrie's Builders.
"He's a big, braw boy. Good stubble on his chin. No as cheery like as the old man. Keeps himself to himself, but bright, they say. A good head on him. And there's nobody else. Bob always tell me ready to tack the wheel." So gie the lad a chance, eh?
And indeed, Davy did have an old head on young shoulders. He quickly understood that without the right political connections, the company's work would dry up almost immediately. So he, too, joined the party, not bothering with the young socialists or any of that militant rubbish, and found he could speak well at meetings to creasy, crumpled, half-cut older men. He wrote checks. He turned up for the quiet one-to-ones in back rooms. He picked up the council minutes before they'd been typed. He played a round or two well enough with lawyers and surveyors. As for the lads themselves, he learned the forenames and the nicknames and the kids' names. He could tell Bluey from Ham, Sparks from Jerry Antrim. He learned who lived with his mother and who was the bright-eyed woman in the office with two men at home, not one. He turned up at the ward meetings and the branch meetings and sat patiently while lonely men rehearsed the history of the party and the mistakes of the current leadership. He was sent to the Constituency General Management Committee and, with only a year under his belt, was chosen as a delegate to the National Party Conference. It was there that the drug of politics first entered his bloodstream, and he realised that perhaps there was more to this game than simply protecting contracts. Home again, and the arguments were vicious, as they were all around Britain at the time. The so-called super colliery had closed in the next constituency. There was still an open cast, but in the dark grey pit villages around Glaycit, the mood was bitter, though too mournful to be revolutionary. David Petrie defended his party leader with a passion and fluency he hadn't realised he had. It didn't make him popular, at least to start with, but it did get him listened to. By his early 20s, he was almost as big a figure in the town as his father had been in the village. But he didn't stand for the council. He could either use his connections and reputation to build the business and keep his mother secure, or he could renounce all of that. And for what? Ayrshire, Scotland, and the Labour Party could manage well enough without him. So every day he came into work as Petrie's vans pulled up outside the unfinished Keir Hardy Close or James Maxton Way. As the number of girls in the office doubled, then doubled again. As the smarmy wee prod at the Clydesdale agreed a much bigger loan. As he bought out a local scaffolding company and leased a dozen new cement mixers, young Davy Petrie would smile to himself and think, "Fuck you, Big Bob. Aye, you second-rate cunt." So Petrie sat out the fag end of the Blair and Brown years, making money and growing thicker and growing the company too. He married up, an Edinburgh graduate who had been to a posh school in St. Andrews and whose father farmed a big estate. He built his own house, using stone from a new quarry north of Glasgow, and built a new bungalow for his mother next door to it. He fathered two children and was a notably gentle and loving father to them. His PA noted that for the first time he was leaving work before 9 p.m. and told the office, "It'll be the making of him." These were the years of the Scottish National Party's triumphant hegemony. Labour folk in Scotland sucked sour plums, kept themselves to themselves. Petrie didn't waver in his allegiance, but he made sure to get on well with his local MSP and even to oil up to the housing minister in Edinburgh. He was old enough, just about, by now, to play both sides. From the outside, there was no doubt. David Petrie had survived, and more. Inside, it wasn't so easy. He struggled with his wife. He was slow to express affection. He hated being touched. At times, triggered by the most meaningless, trivial things, one of his sons laughing on the telephone, losing some paperwork, he would be overwhelmed by a black rage that had him shaking, his fists bawling, his teeth clenched. This scared him, and he learned to deal with it, turning his back and walking away, using breathing exercises he'd been taught at a gym class. He kept himself fit. He liked to walk up the braes behind the village where there was a little birch wood and a burn running down. He'd squat down and stare at the magic of the colourless water running over green stones and rub his fingers on the moss and smell the wild garlic. He loved the view that spread out in the distance. Wobbly blue lines of Ayrshire hills with Glaikit and the colliery hidden in the foreground. Good times. Well, mostly. Even then, some days there was a blankness from the moment he awoke. A wall of white vapour, a background drone. He felt almost outside himself. Some other dim creature, it seemed, a badly put together, ungainly homunculus, was acting the part of David Petrie. Away from Glaikit, they might have called it depression. There were occasions, in the pub or at Tesco's, when he bumped into loutish young men he'd known as boys at school. In their presence, he felt himself shrinking. The wounds weren't yet quite healed. By the time David Cameron and his snooty coalition were in office, David Petrie was being asked to speak to Labour conferences on behalf of small business. Not that small by now. He had money in his pocket. He had become a past master at the art of influence peddling. Money flowed out of Petrie Associates into the pockets of Labour councillors and council officials. More money flowed out of the council coffers into Petrie building projects. He had a mastermind brain, right enough. Special subject? Aye, planning permission. David chose to distribute a little of his wealth to his party during the Miliband years, largely because of a long-standing feud with the local Scottish National Party. He helped fund the Better Together campaign against independence in 2014. Close call, but his nationalist minister friend from Edinburgh rang him at home and warned him that he was making a big mistake. A new Scottish state would be looking at major house-building projects and would remember its friends. David told him where to go.
Aye, right, on a way to Kelty with you, minister.
They used to say not so long ago that when the devil had finished building hell, he used the rubble for Kelty, in Fife. For Davy and his kind, the referendum marked a complete change. It started with comments in the pub about the Labour Party being shoulder to shoulder with the Tories. Then there was some nasty business. A woman put up a no poster in her window, and her neighbour, whom she'd known since they were girls, came round chapping at the door.
"Planning on staying long, Elsie?" "Which you mean, Sally Catherine? All my life." "Eh, but your kind will not be welcome round here after the 18th. Just a gentle word."
Or so the story went. David never met Elsie, and no one could say exactly where she lived. More worrying were the question time sessions in the school, heaving with yes supporters and the spread of Scotland Be Brave posters in the shop windows. A daft, sexy girl in a kilt wee red hair, and a general feeling in the coffee shops and pubs of the town that it was nobler to be yes than no. Was he still even on the right side? Once upon a time, no Catholic would have dreamed of going anywhere near the damned nationalists. But that sleek-eyed Alex Salmond seemed to have won the Archbishop round somehow. These days, if you boasted a season ticket at Celtic Park, you were almost certainly a yes-man. So Davy's moral and political planet began to crumble at its little green edges. There was even talk that the SNP would take the constituency from Labour for the first time ever. They were certainly digging in up north in Glasgow, though hereabouts there was a strong local party still with the old inherited NUM discipline. Lanky Boswell, Davy's second cousin who'd gone on to uni in Dundee and come back as a primary teacher and raving gnat, would seek him out some nights in the pub after work and give him gyp.
"See here, Petrie, you're a good guy. You just haven't been paying notice and you find yourself on the wrong side. Folk around here don't like you playing footsie with the Tories. They just want no bedroom tax, keep the health service going, denigrate the faces of the folk on welfare. All the things you want too, I know, Davy. What's the problem?"
"The London Labour Party's corrupt. Just pale blue Tories.
It's not too late to come over. We're a broad church, and we're friendly folk. You ken most of us already."
Davy would respond with his old lecture on the tartan Tories and the importance of solidarity and of building social democracy right across the United Kingdom. But he found himself almost wearying of his own arguments. The truth was, the yes folk had made some bloody good points. Quite a few local party members had defected. Inside, Petrie was still angry and bored, but when it came to politics, it was all too obvious that time was short. If he was a Labour man, it was time either to do the necessary or to get off the pot.